Welcome to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz, a candid conversation as we learn about types of dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, frontal temporal, and Lewy body, and the effects on the people we love. Jill's years of dedication and experience help you adapt, overcome obstacles, and find positive outcomes. It's time for Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Well, hello, everybody. I thought today, for a subject I have not brought up in the past in depth anyway, I would talk about clinical trials and why they are important in the overall scheme of trying to work for a better life without Alzheimer's and other dementias, but specifically Alzheimer's today. And I'm going to talk about why it's important to have clinical trials in general, what they are, what are the risks, what are the myths versus facts, why you should involve your doctor in the process, and so on and so on. But before I get started with that, I thought just as an example, I would give you some milestones that have happened over the last 114 years and why participating in research is so important. Yeah, granted, we don't have a cure yet. We don't. We're not there. There are several really great clinical trials going on around the world. And at some point in time, I will talk to you about those on a different show and bring you up to date because we just had the International Conference on Alzheimer's. And this year it was in Dublin, Ireland. And I think it was a really good turnout. In terms of virtually people that logged on and were able to participate in it that wouldn't have been able to before. But why is it important? What has happened over the years? How did we get to where we are? And so forth. So I think that's the way I'll start. But I want you to get a pad and a paper if you are interested at all in clinical trials and participating. I think a lot of people, and I get a lot of calls about this, I will get a phone call saying, my mom just died and I'd like to donate her brain to science. Well, it doesn't work that way. In order for you to donate your brain or to even try to expand on, you know, the familial aspect for your family, you have to participate in a clinical trial prior to that person dying. And I don't mean a week, I don't mean a month, I mean years. It does not do researchers any good at all to get a brain they have not studied, a brain that they don't know anything about that person, their personality, the changes in their personality, the changes in the aspects of the lobes of the brain and where the impairment took place and how it took place. All of these are important things and information that doctors and researchers need to address and look at and study over time. And then when that person dies, they will study what was going on in the brain while they collected all this data. So it just is not, it doesn't work that way to just say, can I donate a brain? And it helps enormously in the course of looking for a cure if you jump in and follow the clinical trials and get involved in a clinical study, and then you yourself might be open to better drugs and drugs that are on the horizon that someday will become mainstream. There are at least four research clinical trials going on around the world. Two in the United States that I'm aware of, and two in one in Australia and one in New Zealand that show promise in slowing the progression of the disease. And these are science-based. This is science-based research, so it's not a doctor oh, I forgot his name now, but he drives me crazy. The guy who says he can cure Alzheimer's with a keto diet and supplements. Bredesen, Dale Bredesen at UCLA. It's not his kind of thing. It's actual clinical scientific research. So I wanted to go through these various milestones over the years and how we got to where we are. So back in 1906, way back there, was the first discovery, okay? And Dr. Alois Alzheimer's first described a peculiar disease. He didn't know what to think. So he was a German physician, and he was a pioneer in linking symptoms to microscopic brain changes. And he went ahead and he described in depth the haunting case of a person named Augusta Dieter. And she was a patient who had profound memory loss, unfounded suspicions about her family and other worsening psychological changes. And in her brain at autopsy, he first saw dramatic shrinkage, atrophy of the brain, and abnormal deposits in and around nerve cells, which we now call plaques and tangles. Okay, it's the beta amyloid that causes plaques and tangles. And in her brain at autopsy, he really thought, wow, this is crazy. How can she have all these huge clumps of nerve cells that seem to be tangled together and stuck together and disconnected from other parts of her brain? Okay, so it was pretty late in his research and his life as a whole. Augusta Dieter was only 51 at the time, by the way, in 1906. But in 1915, Dr. Alzheimer's died, never, ever, ever, ever suspecting that his encounter with Augusta Dieter would one day touch the lives of millions of people and ignite a massive international research effort. And scientists all over the world recognized Dr. Alzheimer's not only for his groundbreaking characterization of a major disease like this one, but also as a role model. He set literally a new standard for understanding neurodegenerative disorders by establishing a close clinical relationship with his patients. It was important to him to get to know his patients and to understand them, just like I was talking about a minute ago. And then using the new scientific tools that he had to determine how the symptoms related to physical brain changes. That was pretty astounding for 1906. I mean, really, that was like crazy. And so in 1910, here's another one of those milestones. In 1910, Emil Kraepelin, a German psychiatrist who worked with Dr. Alzheimer's, first named the disease Alzheimer's disease in a book he was writing, and it was called Psychiatry, I-E, not Y, Psychiatry. And he named it after Dr. Alzheimer's, thinking that this would be a tribute to the man. And he was still alive, but he said, Dr. Alzheimer's, I think we should name this disease after you because of your finding the plaques and tangles in the brain. And it kind of went from there. Now, there have been many a physician who discovered various diseases, and especially neurological brain diseases. Dr. Pick is one of them. And his family did not want frontal temporal degeneration named after him. So they had it changed from Pick's disease to FTD several years ago. So there are people that just, they make great discoveries, but these devastating diseases, they are not too excited about having them named after them, at least their families in years past. So now fast forward another 21 years. And this was an amazing, amazing discovery. In 1931, Germans Knoll, K-N-O-L-L. I cannot talk right today, friends. bear with me. And Ernest Ruschka co-invented the electronic microscope, which could magnify at that time up to 1 million times. It wasn't until after World War II that the electronic microscope becomes common in major research settings and enabled scientists to study brain cells in more detail. So eventually that sort of turned into the PET scan, the PET imaging scan, which is like totally freaking cool. And not everybody can walk into a hospital or a doctor's office and get a PET scan because they're so expensive still to this day in 2020. It's something like 30 to 60 grand to get a PET scan of your brain. They use PET scans in the research for Alzheimer's, I know for a fact, here in Denver and also in at Harvard at the Brigham's Women's Hospital run by Risa Sperling. They use the PET scan when they shoot the Pittsburgh B compound, the PB compound, into the brain of a person. It's like a dye that goes into the brain of a person with Alzheimer's, and they can see live Alzheimer's now. I should have saved that for down the line in the mileage here, but all this is connected to way back in 1931, right? So now, 1968, I was 7 years old, by the way, researchers developed the first validated measurement scale for assessing cognitive and functional decline in older adults. So that paved the way to correlate the level of measured impairment with estimates of the number of brain lesions and the volume of damaged tissue in someone's brain. That's huge. So being able just to see how a brain deteriorates over time when you have Alzheimer's and you have the beta amyloid causing the plaques and tangles in your brain. So I was 7 years old when that came along. So now it gets a little bit more fun. In 1970 to 1979 was the founding of the National Institute on Aging, the NIA. And it was an act of Congress that established the National Institute of Aging as one of our National Institutes of Health, NIH. And the NIA is our primary federal agency supporting Alzheimer's research. And to this day, and that was in 1974, to this day, they are the number one contributor to Alzheimer's research in the United States. And they often have to have an act of Congress to get that money, but it has continued since its inception in 1974. In 1976, Alzheimer's was recognized as the most common form of dementia. Back in 1976. So to put that in perspective again, I don't know how it applies to all of you, but that was my first year of high school. So Alzheimer's was recognized as the most common form of dementia. Why is that important? Well, it's important because prior to that time, they were calling Alzheimer's by other names, senility, hardening of the arteries, things like that. And if your grandparents had it back in the day, prior to 1976, they would call it by those names. They're accurate in their description, hardening of the arteries. That's the plaques and the tangles and the hardness and the breaking off of the neurons and their connections and the lack of synapses to make a brain thought complete. All that is what is how you would see it under a microscope, how you would see it in the brain of a person. But we didn't really have a name for it. We didn't really say it was Alzheimer's, even though here all these years earlier, in 1906, you know, they were already calling it Alzheimer's. Interesting, huh? So they said, all right, this is what we think it is. And at that point, I think even probably Parkinson's, if anybody had FTD, if anybody had Lewy body, it was all lumped under Alzheimer's at that time. Now, in 1980, awareness started to be more known about Alzheimer's. We were trying to destigmatize it. And that wasn't an easy thing to do. If you had a loved one that was termed crazy or senile, people were mostly afraid of them. They didn't want to talk to them. They didn't want to deal with them. They thought they could catch it because it was contagious and stuff like that. Well, that's when the Alzheimer's Association was founded in 1980. Actually, in 1979, Jerome Stone, he's the big kahuna of the Alzheimer's Association, and representatives from several family support groups met with the National Institute on Aging to explore, would there be a value of a national independent nonprofit organization to complement and stimulate federal efforts on Alzheimer's disease? If they could get a big organization going, like a great big freight train, and start getting people to talk about this disease and participate and support each other and create support groups and things like that, it might get a movement that could get the Congress base off their butt and give money towards research. And so that was the plan, right? And that meeting resulted in the 1980 formation of the Alzheimer's Association with Mr. Stone, Jerome Stone, as the founding president. Today, in our world right now, the Alzheimer's Association is the leading voluntary health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. And it's really wild because at that time there was one. There was one. And it was in Chicago. And that's why the national office is in Chicago. Now there's like 80 offices across the country, which is amazing. It could be more than that, but I think there's around 80. So that was a pretty big deal to come up with some new plan of how we could be available to families to talk to them when they had these problems and help them along the journey when they had somebody with this disease. So in 1983, the Declaration of National Alzheimer's Disease Month was set into play. And that's November. It's November every year. You should turn your house purple. You should get a sign in the front of your house. Whatever, whatever. But get involved in clinical trials. Do something, because the month is November. And in 1983, it was designated. And it's been that way ever since. Now, in 1984... this is connected really to Alois Alzheimer's back in 1906. But in 1984, beta amyloid was actually identified. Dr. Alzheimer's recognized the plaques and the tangles, but he at that time didn't know what they were caused by. And herein lies the difference. So in 1984, researchers, George Glenner and Kaien Wong, reported identification of a novel cerebrovascular amyloid protein. Say that three times fast, right? Known as beta amyloid, the chief component of Alzheimer's brain plaques and a prime suspect in triggering nerve cell damage. So 1984. And then also in 1984, a nationwide infrastructure for Alzheimer's research was established. It's crazy, isn't it, to think at that time, what was happening in 1984? Bon Jovi was one of the biggest bands in the country. AC/DC was a big band in the country. I'm trying to think what kind of movies we had. E.T., you know, E.T. phone home kind of thing. What other things were happening in 1984? That would be worth having a little trivia over, wouldn't it? That'd be kind of fun. But just thinking about things like that. In 1984, we had 8-track tapes. We did not have CD players. We did not have flash drives. Computers were not used in schools. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but a lot of the world has changed at this point in time. It's pretty crazy, right? All right. So in 1986, researchers around the world were saying, you know, we don't think it's plaques and tangles that causes Alzheimer's. And they were just kind of considered rogue research labs that were kind of off on their own. And the majority of researchers and doctors felt that the plaques and tangles were, in fact, the cause and the result of beta amyloid protein attacking the brain. And they wouldn't listen to the tau people. But in 1986, tau protein was identified. And that's huge. That's what my mom had. That's what she had in her brain. So researchers discovered that tau protein, T-A-U, is a key component of the tangles, not the plaque, not the sticky stuff, not the beta amyloid, but the tangles, how the neurofibrillary fibers break off and tangle together. And it is the second pathological hallmark of Alzheimer's disease and other and another prime suspect in nerve cell degeneration. So we've learned a lot over the years about these two different proteins. A few years ago, I was at a grand round at the University of Colorado Hospital, and I was listening to Dr. Alan Holtzman, who is the primary researcher at Washington University in St. Louis, and he runs the research lab there. And he was saying he thinks that the beta amyloid is on the inside of the brain and the tau is on the outside of the brain, you know, kind of around the cerebellum that is the casing for the whole brain. And that was the first time I'd ever heard that. And that was a couple of years ago. But it looks like he was kind of going off of, you know, what happened in 1986 that identified the tau in the first place. I'm a little disappointed that we haven't learned as much about tau as we need to. We haven't gone down that road quite as exhaustive as we have for the beta amyloid over the years. But maybe someday we'll get there, right? All right. So in 1987... the first Alzheimer's drug trial took place, and that was pretty big. So the Alzheimer's Association assists the NIA, the National Institute of Aging, and Warner Lambert Pharmaceutical Company, now called Pfizer, we all know Pfizer, in the launching and recruiting of participants for clinical trials of Tactrine, the first drug specifically targeting symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. That drug is long gone and did not work, but it was the very first trial that they had trying to figure this out. So now, 1987, researchers identify the first gene associated with rare inherited forms of Alzheimer's disease. This gene on chromosome 21 codes amyloid precursors and protein, APP, the parent molecule from which beta amyloid is formed. Now that's huge, because I've said to you on the show before, who else has a problem with chromosome 21? Well, it's people with Down syndrome. So interesting, right? Chromosome 21 is also the chromosome of which those with Down syndrome have three copies rather than two. Many individuals with Down syndrome develop Alzheimer's disease, often as young as 30 and 40. We now know that if a person with Down syndrome lives to be 35, they will have the full-blown pathology to have Alzheimer's disease, all based on that chromosome 21. I just think that's wild, because people with Alzheimer's have problems with that same chromosome, but they don't have Down syndrome. I always think that's like the $64,000 question. Now, in 1990, you know, it's hard to believe that it's only been like 30 years, but in 1990, some treatments started emerging. So in 1991, The NIA established Alzheimer's Disease Cooperative Study, ADCS, a nationwide medical network to facilitate clinical research and conduct federally funded clinical trials. They were corralling them all together. They were saying, all right, if you guys want to really study this, let's start putting them at university hospitals. Let's start taking this to a different level. Let's really get some researchers and pay researchers to not work in little rogue labs all over the world. Let's bring all these researchers together and start talking to each other and making clinical trials that the government would pay for. You know, we've struggled over the years getting the government to pay for these things, but hopefully they will continue and we'll get to the finish line at some point. So in 1993, the first Alzheimer's risk factor gene was identified. And that was the APOE4. I've talked about that over and over and over on the show. So the APOE4 is, it's a gene on chromosome 19, not 21. And it was first thought to be the first gene that raises risk for Alzheimer's but does not determine that a person who has it will develop the disease. So that's pretty huge. You can actually have the gene and never get the disease. Therefore, this is why when people ask me, should they get a blood test or something like that, that can tell them whether or not they have the precursor for Alzheimer's, I always say, don't do it unless you're having signs, because why worry about it your whole life? You may have the gene and never actually get it. So in 1993, the first Alzheimer's drug was approved by the FDA, and it was Tacrin. Its generic was called Cognex, and it was the first drug specifically targeting Alzheimer's memory and thinking symptoms. Four additional drugs were approved over the next 10 years. They were Aricept, Namenda, and Exelon. So I don't know that there was a – they say there was a fourth one, but I don't know what the fourth one was. But I know those three were. In 1994, President Reagan, the first president ever, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So the former president, Ronald Reagan, shared with the American people that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. In an open letter to the American people about his decision to share his diagnosis, Reagan wrote, quote, "In opening our hearts, we hope this might promote greater awareness of this condition. Perhaps it will encourage a clearer understanding of the individuals and families who are affected by it," end quote. Really a brave thing for an American president to do. Super cool, I think. In 1994, we had the first World Alzheimer's Day, and that was September 21st. The Alzheimer's Association decided that under their umbrella, they would start launching a walk on that date. The Denver Walk is always on the third Saturday in September. But it's called World Alzheimer's Day. Why it's not in November, I don't know. So it has a day on a separate month. That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? So anyway, that was pretty cool. In 1995, we had the first transgenic mouse model announced. They had a mouse that developed Alzheimer's-like brain pathology, and the mouse was developed by inserting one of the human APP genes to have this mouse develop a rare neurological disorder called, oh my goodness, it's a really strong German name. Gerstmann-Strassler-Shanker syndrome in 1989, laying the technical foundation for Alzheimer's mouse models. Now, for those of you who don't like us using animals in these studies, sorry about that, but it is what it is. And in 1999, the first series of reports published showing that injected transgenic Alzheimer's mice with beta amyloid prevents the animals from developing plaques and other Alzheimer's-like brain changes. So that was the first time that they were ever able to give a mouse this disease and actually recognize how it was progressing in the brain. We're going to take a break. I'll finish these milestones. And in the second half, I'm going to talk to you about clinical trials and what they are, what the risks are, and so on and so forth. We'll be right back.
Living and working with Alzheimer's and other dementias can often be challenging. Summit Resilience Training provides education utilizing non-medical approaches for those who work with our friends affected by dementia. Believing families still need one-on-one assistance, we provide classes which help them understand the diseases affecting their loved ones, offering strategies and techniques for success with activities of daily living and working with confusing behaviors. We offer in-home assessments to clarify symptoms of dementia diseases and help families work together to find moments of joy while living with memory loss and impairment. Education programs instilling person-centered care philosophies are offered for professional caregivers working in communities and homes, which can be customized for their staff. Training is also available for first responders, such as law enforcement, fire, and EMT personnel. We are passionate that people with dementias, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and others, are approached with compassion and understanding, and those who work with them have all the tools they need for success. Call us at Summit Resilience Training, 303-420-6988, to schedule a class or in-home assessment. Visit our website at summitresiliencetraining.com for more information.
Welcome back to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
Okay, so we're talking about the milestones, the things that happened along the route as we have learned more and more and more about Alzheimer's, what we think causes it, the introduction of research, the introduction of mice in research, and moving forward, and I will wrap this up in just a minute and get on with the clinical trials. In 2003, the National Alzheimer's Disease Genetic Study began. 2003, 17 years ago. That's kind of crazy, isn't it? It took all that time. It took all that time for them to bring people in. That's kind of shocking to me. So the Alzheimer's Association partnered with the National Institute on Aging to actually recruit participants for their disease genetic study. And it was a federal initiative to collect and bank blood samples from families with several members who developed Alzheimer's disease late in life in order to identify additional Alzheimer's risk genes, if there were more out there than just chromosome 19 and chromosome 21, and what gene mutations like the APOE4 were affected. Those were the major questions. In 2004 was the first time that they reported success with the Pittsburgh B compound. So it's called PIB, or Pittsburgh compound B. It just sounds backwards to me. I've been saying it backwards, I guess, for a while. But at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease, they shared their first report on an imaging agent called Pittsburgh compound B, PIB, a major potential breakthrough in disease monitoring and early detection. So PIB, this compound, enters through the brain and through the bloodstream and attaches itself to the beta amyloid deposits, where it can be detected by positron emission tomography, which is the PET scan. That's the big word. We just call it PET scan because it's easier to say. The Alzheimer's Association provided significant support to initiatives to develop PIB, the Pittsburgh compound, and conduct preclinical testing in animal studies. Again, those poor little mice, but those mice are going to get us to the finish line. In 2004, private donors started becoming major sponsors of research. That's the first time they started reaching out to people and trying to ask them to help in the study, not just the government, because the government wasn't releasing a whole lot of money and getting them where they needed to be. So they started asking families and private donors, public donors, to be a major sponsor of Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, ADNI, and it was a nationwide study back in 2004 to establish standards for obtaining and interpreting brain images. The goal of ADNI was to determine whether standardized images, possibly combined with laboratory and psychological tests, could identify high-risk individuals and provide early detection and track and monitor treatments and effects, especially in clinical trials of the disease and the modifying drugs that they were using. Why is that important? So breaking that down for you, essentially that's where they introduced neurobehavioral exams to what they were doing with blood that they were drawing and imaging they were using, so on and so forth. So prior to that, they were just using the science, just the science. What they could see on their screens, what they could see on their through their microscopes and everything else, but they decided that the big thing was going to be how can we make a great big database, take information from sitting down and talking to somebody from anywhere from an hour to 4 hours, and learning about how their brain works, get us to a place where we could learn more and use their autopsy at that point to help us to understand a little better what was going on. So that was pretty huge. And in 2005, the Alzheimer's and Dementia Journal was launched, where people could support a global interdisciplinary exchange within the Alzheimer's Research Committee. So that was, again, connecting all these researchers so we know what each other is doing and they're not just competing with one another and never sharing. We needed to have a collaborative effort so that we can move forward. In 2008, the Alzheimer's Association and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention launched the Healthy Brain Initiative with a publication of a national public health roadmap to maintaining cognitive health. This is where we started talking to people about eating better and exercising and so on and so forth, hoping that they could literally emphasize primary prevention of cognitive impairment and stop what they could, where they could, and look for interventions that would work someday, maybe being able to stave off the disease by what they had learned. So I've had Breanne Betcher on the show talking about what she's doing in this department, which was just absolutely, absolutely huge, right? So from that point on, things have just grown and grown and grown. In 2009, they started doing the International Conference on Alzheimer's Disease, and it became an annual event where they would share not only with other researchers but with the public if they wanted to come. Huge, huge, huge. And also in 2009, efforts to standardize biomarkers. So what they were seeing in the lab, what they were looking at in terms of the PET scans and what they were seeing in spinal fluid. Huge. They started measuring spinal fluid so that they could see how much spinal fluid someone had that had the beta amyloid, so they could see whether or not it was going to go up their spine, up to their brainstem, and they would end up with Alzheimer's. So back in 2009, that's only been 11 years. I mean, it feels like we should have come a lot farther. It's surprising to me a little bit that it was only 2009 when they started doing that. But that sounds about right. That's when I first got spinal fluid taken out of me. So that's about right. So anyway, they started the walks and the 66-day bike rides in 2010. In 2010 also, they established the clinical trial database that you could go on and sign up for a clinical trial, which is huge, right? And through all of this, through everything they've learned, through everything they put together over 100 years, they finally determined that Alzheimer's was the sixth leading cause of U.S. deaths. That's amazing. And that it's more than even heart disease at this point or breast cancer. So we've had a lot of things that came along the way that, you know, how we've had, you know, presidents working with us and trying to help us with what they could in terms of money and funding and so on and so forth. President Obama was one of the best. In 2011, he signed a groundbreaking legislation establishing our first ever framework for a national strategic plan to address Alzheimer's disease crisis and to coordinate our response on multiple fronts, including research, care, and support. Thank you, President Obama, for that. That was really, really a pretty cool thing to have happen. All right. So I've talked a lot about the trial, you know, why, what's happened, how we've come across the years and gone from just Dr. Alzheimer's recognizing the plaques and tangles to somebody giving it a name and naming it after him and so on and so forth. But why would you want to be in a clinical trial? Well, clinical trials essentially, really truly, are just research studies that are conducted with human volunteers. And they're trying to figure out, is what they're doing safe? Are they going to hurt anybody during this clinical trial? Are we going to be effective with what we're doing? Without clinical research and the help of participants, there can't be any treatment. There can't be any prevention. There will never be a cure. We have to have people join us in this, in these research studies, or we're never going to get the answer of how we're going to solve this disease. So we need people to get involved. And the way you can do that is trial match. It's free. It's easy to use. It matches individuals living with Alzheimer's disease, caregivers, and healthy volunteers with current research studies. That's all it is. It's continually updated. It can tell you what's going on in the country, why, you know, what you could be involved with, what pharmaceutical advances they're making. Some people get the drug that is they think is going to try and cure what it is they're studying, and others will get one that is like a placebo, and it's done in every trial is done that way. So they might have 50% of the people to get the actual drug they're trying to develop, and 50 will get the placebo, and they need to do that to see whether or not this is effective. They have to have ways to measure whether it's effective for you folks. So here's the thing, people. You can just hope and pray for a cure, or you can get involved. And I practice what I preach. I walk the walk and I talk the talk here because my family has been in a study. We're part of it. We've given my mom's brain to science. They're going to get my brother's brain. They're going to get my sister's brain. We're doing what we can. We really are. So the reason why I wanted to talk to you about this today is to say, come on, let's kick into gear. Let's get involved in a clinical study. These are the way that we can test new treatments. Before a new drug or a treatment can be approved by the FDA, you have to go through three phases of clinical trials. If they don't have people to do that, we're not going to get it done, right? Three phases. I've talked about this at length, about the first 7 years typically is making sure that it's safe for all the participants. The second 7 years is trying it on humans, starting with anywhere from 20 to 40 and then getting it up to 400 to 1,000. And then once you see if it's working on those people, can you sustain the drug? Can it help for a long period of time? Is it just helping for the minute they take it, or is it going to work for 6 months, or is it going to work for a year? You know, what's going to happen? And they use the best new therapies with the best known existing therapies that they can that are being studied, and then they have to have something to compare it to. So if they don't have people in here in these trials, they can't do it, right? So the whole idea about the treatments is that if they can get a drug, even if they don't have great efficacy, like we know that Exelon and Namenda and Aricept are very, very limited in their efficacy. It's generally the first year. Some studies have said that Aricept works on Lewy body patients in late stages, which I find fascinating. But in general, they haven't been very great. And the whole thing is that they're really aimed at slowing or stopping the disease, but these particular drugs haven't worked that well. We can't stop there, though. We have to keep going. We have to keep trying to get to this finish line and figure out what drugs might work. What are some new ways of treating the diseases? So most of the studies are focused on finding better ways to accurately diagnose Alzheimer's disease, especially in the early stages. But hopefully they'll lead to a trusted and easy to apply method that enables physicians to diagnose a person at risk for the disease and even before symptoms appear, and then begin treatment and hopefully slow the progression. That's the main goal of any drug that they can come up with, okay? So what they're looking for with these diagnostic studies are really to take it to another level, to be able to intercept and move on earlier in the stages of somebody having the disease and say, oh, can diet and exercise make a difference? Are there ways that we can slow the disease? So some types of these research trials are prevention trials, where researchers look for ways to stop Alzheimer's disease from developing. Some are quality of life studies, where researchers try to better understand and address the needs of the people with the disease and their caregivers and their family members, and how can they support them and educate them, and so on and so forth. Other types of research are online studies, which explore the same kinds of questions as other studies, but are able to complete. They're able to be completed online without requiring a visit to a particular site or a doctor or a hospital or whatever it is. So those are some of the kinds of trials there are: prevention trials, quality of life studies, and online studies. As an overview, what are the benefits? What is a benefit to, you know, belonging to this? Well, be part of the cure. That's the biggest thing. For me anyway, that's what I think. Participating in a clinical trial, honestly, folks, it gives you the potential to both help the participant, maybe you yourself or other family members, and the person who has Alzheimer's disease, and really say, all right, can I be more active in my own health care? Can I get access to potential treatments before they're widely available? That's huge. Can you receive expert medical care at leading health care facilities? Yeah, absolutely. And often they're free. So in the meantime, you're not only getting all that, but you're contributing to Alzheimer's research. Is there a risk? Is there any risk to this? Well, that is always going to be the most important aspect, especially in the first 7 years. They're trying to figure out, you know, and quantify how safe this is, and are we following rules so no one will die, and so on and so forth. The procedures for each study are always reviewed by an expert committee. It's called the RIB. It's a Research Initiative Bureau or something like that, RIB. And they're not directly involved in the trial, so they help ensure that you're protected and safe. So this governing body, and they're in Florida, by the way, they try to minimize the risk and oversee whatever clinical trial it is that you're participating in to make sure that it has all the safety measures put in place. Yeah, there's risk. There may be unpleasant or even some serious side effects sometimes to the potential treatments being studied. The experimental treatment may not be effective. That's definitely a risk. And, you know, generally they'll try to spell out what are the risks in the consent form, but they can't always cover everything. I'll give you an example of one of the risks. If you get the spinal fluid taken, sometimes it can make your lower back ache. It can have some consequences if you have lower lumbar issues. But hey, you know, it's worth the risk if you're trying to find a cure, and especially if you're a person that has a diagnosis. Why should we be optimistic? Well, there was a person named Ron G. who said, I never had the ability to help anybody with Alzheimer's until I got the disease and participated in a clinical trial. It'd be hard to overstate the importance of getting involved. And it turned out that he could be a trial match person, and Ranji is a person that is, you know, doing what he can to try and find a cure and get us where we need to go. One of the important things is that the participants actually get access to major research initiatives, doctors that are studying this disease. They care about what's happening to you. You get a high standard of care. It's just, it's a good thing. It's a good thing to be a part of. And whether or not the experimental treatment works or not, it's just, it's good to be a part of something that you know could possibly help down the line. My mom was a part of that. And 4 years after her death, they found a major discovery of a C9ORF mutation that she had, which was really, really rare. And they've studied her brain over and over and over. She died in 2012, and they're still studying it today. This stuff is cool. It's cool. And it helps you to get where you need to get. Now, if you're going to do this, it's important to talk to your doctor. So when you become part of a clinical trial, you will still receive care from your primary doc for your overall day-to-day health, right? Most trials are only for a limited time and only pertain to the condition being studied, not anything but your brain, right? So your doctor is important. So when the next time you go to your doctor, ask if a clinical trial might be right for you. Your doctor knows both you and your health history, which makes him or her a good resource to talk over whether participating in an Alzheimer's research clinical trial might be beneficial. And your doctor can help you gather information and identify what questions might be important to ask before you decide to participate. And then you need to locate a clinical trial. So you can use Trial Match. Just Google it, okay? And locate a research study that you might be eligible for. And it can help you to understand several things about your health before even starting when you answer survey questions. And some of those questions might be, what is my clinical diagnosis? Do I have Alzheimer's disease, mild cognitive impairment, dementia otherwise not specified, other dementias like Lewy body or vascular, which we know is a stroke? And what tests were used to diagnose my Alzheimer's disease or to assess what stage I'm in? Well, the tests that they use are cognitive tests, those neurobehavioral exams I was telling you about. They'll either do an MRI or a CT scan or a PET scan, which they call neuroimaging, or they haven't done anything at all. They haven't done any tests. They'll ask what medications you currently take. Are you taking Aricept or Exelon? Razidine, that's the other one, or Namenda. So generally, if you're in an early stage trial, they would be asking these kinds of questions. And questions to consider before participating. Work really closely with your research team to understand what the benefits and the risks are. You might find it helpful to go over the trial information with your doctor before making your final decision, right? And the National Institute on Aging suggests asking the trial team a bunch of questions before you start. So here's a few of them. What's the purpose of the study? What tests and treatment will be given? Will it hurt? I'm going to tell you those, when they get that spinal fluid from you and the lower part of your back, for me, that's not comfortable, but I have lower lumbar issues and that's why it bothers me. Are there any side effects? Am I going to have a backache for days and days? Is it going to make my lower lumbar worse? What may happen with or without this research? Is it going to go on to other places? Is it going to be shared with other people? Can I continue with treatments for Alzheimer's and other conditions prescribed by my regular doctor? These are great questions. I'll put these on my website so you can have access to them if you want to participate in Trial Match. I'll put it on the podcast information from this show, okay? How will you keep my doctor informed about my participation in the trial? Does the study compare with standard and experimental treatments? How long will it last? Will it be months and months? Will it be a couple weeks? How much time will it take? An hour every time I'm there or 2 hours? What's going to happen? Where and when will the testing occur? Can I do it at my house or do I need to go to a local office? How much flexibility will I have? How will it affect my activities? If I withdraw, will this affect my normal care? Will I learn the results? That's a good one. Could I receive placebo? They're not going to tell you that right now. I'll tell you. They're not going to tell you. What steps ensure my confidentiality? I don't want my insurance company to know because I don't want them dumping me, right, or not covering me if they find out that I am participating in a trial. You're supposed to be safe there, folks, but Big Brother's always watching. You really need to find out if you don't have long-term care insurance, if you are participating in a research trial for Alzheimer's, will that exclude you from being able to get long-term care insurance? Expenses reimbursed? Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. And will I be paid? These are great research questions, and the research team can handle those and any additional questions you have. Always take a family member or a caregiver with you to make sure all your questions are answered. And work on it from there, okay? Now, what are some of the myths and some of the facts? Here's a myth that there are plenty of volunteers. They don't need you to participate. Oh, yeah, they do. That we need volunteers like crazy in clinical research. Absolutely. A fact on that. New treatments for Alzheimer's disease are nearly impossible without clinical trials and many more participants, including people with dementia or those who are at risk of developing it. Caregivers and healthy volunteers with no dementia issues are urgently needed. Like I told you, Breanne Betcher has gotten on this show and talked about one she's doing where she needs people who are healthy that don't have Alzheimer's so she can study a healthy brain as well. Here's another myth. It's too late. The disease is too advanced to participate in a research study. No. The fact is there are clinical studies that work with people in every stage of Alzheimer's. Participating in a trial could have potentially a measurable impact on the disease. Absolutely. Here's another myth. Clinical trials are dangerous because they use new and unproven methods and medications. Here's the fact about that. Clinical trials are experiments and, as a result, always involve some level of risk. However, the ethical and legal codes that govern medical practice also apply to clinical trials. In addition, most large clinical trials are federally regulated with built-in safeguards to protect participants. There may be some unpleasant or serious, even life-threatening side effects to experimental treatment. Participants should discuss and understand any side effects with their doctor, and they can withdraw at any time. You're not stuck just because you joined. If I join a clinical trial, I won't receive the same quality of care that I currently have with my doctor. No, you'll get better care. You'll have a chance to talk to experts. That's absolutely ridiculous. Here's one myth. There may be painful or invasive procedures as part of the clinical trial. Well, I told you about the spinal thing. Some people it bothers, some people it doesn't. But if you are uncomfortable, if you don't feel good, don't do it, okay? Folks, get on Trial Match. Be part of the cure. Don't be part of the sitting around and praying for a cure. So far, that hasn't gotten us very far. I'm in a clinical trial. I enjoy it. I like being part of the team and the information just so I can provide a lot of good information to all of you. I wish you well. Stop wishing and praying for a prayer. Get involved. Trial Match. Look it up. I'll see you next week on Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz.
You've been listening to Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz. To learn more about her resources, services, classes, or to book speaking engagements, visit Jill's website at summitresiliencetraining.com. A new podcast drops every Tuesday, so join us as we learn more about dementias, resilience, and overcoming obstacles to find a positive outcome. Dementia Resilience with Jill Lorenz can be found on your favorite podcast provider. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating. Musical and technical support provided by Brian Hunter. See you next week.